This week on Making Contact.
We have people in these trailer parks who, let alone money to get a bus ticket, come to New Orleans and find work or come to their jobs, they don't even have enough money to pay for the propane tanks that it takes to heat up a FEMA trailer.
It just seems like they're trying to get rid of the problem simply by getting rid of us.
It's called Renaissance Village, but don't let the name fool you. It's the largest FEMA trailer park in the country, located about 100 miles north of New Orleans in Baker, Louisiana. Right after Hurricane Katrina and Rita, thousands were sent to live here. 2 years after the storm, hundreds are still here. On this edition, we'll hear from people living at the FEMA-run trailer park and from those trying to help them get out. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
There's an underlying but not terribly hidden agenda that the powers that be in New Orleans have for New Orleans. Everybody, whether it's low-wage workers, African-American renters, public housing residents, everybody recognizes that poor people are being displaced from New Orleans. They're not being allowed to return.
That's Saket Soni. He's the director of the New Orleans Workers' Center for Racial Justice, a center created as a response to the changing social and ethnic landscape of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast after the storm. To Saket and the small group of activists who created the center, the situation was a perfect storm for racial tension, divisiveness, and economic abuse. Tens of thousands of migrant workers were arriving to join the rebuilding effort, while at the same time, tens of thousands of African Americans couldn't return to the city they called home for generations, many of them stuck in FEMA trailer parks. Saket sees the displacement of African Americans in New Orleans as part of a calculated plan to change the demographics of the city. I sat down with him this past year at a small office just outside New Orleans.
People who set the public conversation, such as the Times-Picayune and the mayor and other elected officials, started telling the story that as more people returned, the crime rate in New Orleans was increasing. And that was all coded language for who should return and who shouldn't. It was not about all people. It was fueling one side of this debate about who should return. Meanwhile, public housing was going on record saying that they only wanted the best public housing residents to return, that they didn't want gangbangers and they didn't want welfare queens to return. You know, so all of this was coded language about who should return. And if you know the code, when you say crime goes up as more people come back, what that actually means is that crime goes up as African Americans come back. You're not talking about white people coming back to Lakeview or the Garden District. You're talking about poor black people coming back to Central City or back to public housing. There's an association of crime with people of color usually. So this fed into a debate in New Orleans that's still raging about who should return and what areas of New Orleans should be repopulated. The best housing structures in New Orleans, the ones that suffered least from the hurricane, are public housing. But those happen to be the most excluded people. The people who explicitly, by legal, you know, action, have not been allowed to come back. New Orleans was a 67% black city before Katrina. It's now on its way to become a white majority city. According to the last census, New Orleans was whiter, richer, and older. Meanwhile, you know, African Americans are essentially displaced and in exile, and struggling to come home. If they're renters, they can't rent anymore. New Orleans has gone from New Orleans rates to New York rates in the rental market. If you're in public housing, you come back home to find a steel shutter on your door. You'd have to break through housing. You'd have to break through the steel, open your door, and come and live in an apartment without plumbing or electricity if you wanted to come back home. By government decree, all the public housing in New Orleans is frozen. And that's 20,000 people who can't return, which is about a good 10% of the people who are displaced.
After the hurricanes, FEMA trailer parks began springing up all across the Gulf Coast. They were supposed to be just temporary housing, yet these parks are still packed with people who have nowhere else to go. The Workers' Center for Racial Justice works in these trailer parks.
These trailer parks that we're organizing in are largely people who, before Hurricane Katrina, were poor, were renting, were locked into poverty wages in the service industry and construction. They are not people who had access or opportunity before Hurricane Katrina. And after Katrina, even more so. They've been removed from the city that they've called home and put in these places. One of these FEMA trailer parks is called Renaissance Park. It has a very posh name, but it's essentially a enormous sort of prison-like compound of FEMA trailer parks lined up one after another. I think there are probably about close to 4,000 people living there. This is in Baker, Louisiana. And every morning, early morning at about 6 a.m., the only sound you'll hear around the FEMA trailer park, around Renaissance Park, is the slow sound of people walking to pick up the bus. This bus, the Louisiana Swift, will take people on a 3.5-hour drive to New Orleans. One of our grassroots leaders in this FEMA trailer park is a woman named Rose Harrison. Rose Harrison gets up in the morning at 5:30, figures out what to do with her kids that day, gets on the bus, and gets to New Orleans by about 8:30 to start her 9 o'clock shift at Harris. At the end of the day, at 5:30, 6 in the evening, she then gets on the LA Swift again, goes all the way to Renaissance Park. You know, she has a job in New Orleans, but can't afford to live near her job because of price gouging and high rent costs. FEMA has bungled its operation and hasn't allowed her to come back home or put a trailer near her home. Many others like her were renting and are not, as a result, receiving any kind of assistance from the state programs that have been set up to rent out. People like Rose, and I'm changing her name to protect her identity, but people like her are not people who don't like to work. Very much contrary to the general perception that we're fed by mainstream media and political discourse, these are not people who don't want to work. They're all people who were working before the storm. They're all people who would much rather be working now, but there are too many obstacles between them and work. If they were renters, they're not getting any assistance. If they were homeowners, they haven't been allowed to come back, either because of finances or because of FEMA, to come and fix their homes. People are living in these parks waiting for their homes to be gutted, but without money to pay for an electrician. Transportation is another huge issue. Every now and then, somebody gets up and says, we don't have the money to fund the Louisiana Swift. If the LA Swift stops working, 80% of those people will not be able to leave the FEMA trailer parks on any given day. Even with the bus in operation, people barely have money to scrounge up the price of a bus ticket. You know, people haven't worked in months and months, and they just don't have enough money. We have people in these trailer parks who, let alone money to get a bus ticket, come to New Orleans and find work or come to their jobs, they don't even have enough money to pay for the propane tanks that it takes to heat up a FEMA trailer in the winter. So this is the kind of situation that people are living in. there's been a lot of focus on the plight of homeowners after Hurricane Katrina. A lot of groups have come in to help gut homes, rehab homes, et cetera, et cetera. That's very important. But the larger percentage of people displaced by Hurricane Katrina were renters. These are not people who have gotten any assistance at all. And then there was a sizable group, about 10% of that population was public housing residents. These are the two waves of people who have been not just through sophisticated economic means, but actually through very blatant governmental means, they've been totally excluded from returning to New Orleans.
You've just heard Saket Soni, the director of the New Orleans Workers' Center for Racial Justice. We wanted to hear firsthand from the people living in these trailer parks. In August 2007, the People's Production House traveled to Biloxi, Mississippi and Baton Rouge, Louisiana to teach an intensive course in radio documentary to Gulf Coast residents. For nearly 2 weeks, the trainees learned how to use recording equipment, conduct interviews, write scripts, and edit their own work. The story you are about to hear was produced by youth who live in Renaissance Village, Eric Walker, Rashika London, and Kiana London, and the interviews were done by Jackie Suhin from Big Noise Films.
I'm Kiana London. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana.
My name is Rashika. I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. And right now, I'm in Renaissance Village.
Renaissance Village is in Baker, Baton Rouge, on Groom Road. And it's a place where, like, it have, like, a lot of trailer. It's a trailer park.
It have lots of rocks. It's for New Orleans people. They have lots of trees and trailers and cars.
All people are back here because of a hurricane. And the hurricane destroyed their houses and stuff. And they didn't have any place to go, so FEMA, wherever they was, FEMA used to pay for them. But then FEMA must have got tired of paying for them, and they just came to the let them come to this trailer park, the Renaissance Village. And we wasn't back yet because we was in a hotel for a long time, a year. And that's when FEMA said they had some trailers and they would like to give me my mom and my sister number one.
My name's Eric Walker and I'm from New Orleans. Renaissance Village is pretty much in the middle of nowhere. We're located not too far away from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, but we're in an area where farms were pretty much running, so we're basically in the middle of a cow pasture. It's very, very uninteresting here. There's nothing to do, really. I usually stay inside personally. People have lived here since a couple of months after the hurricane. I know I've been here for a long time, but I don't feel the time actually passing. It's sort of like when you're here, you don't realize how long you've been here, and quite literally, because we're living in a place that's so static, you know? It's just this constant that never changes. And I think that has a large effect on the people living here.
I learned how to become a reporter. I had like this tape recorder thing. It was a mini recorder player, something like that. And it helped me learn how to record. So if I want to grow up and be a reporter, I would know how to do some of the stuff. It was fun. I liked it. I want to do it again. My favorite part was when I was recording. I never did do that. But if I did it, it was on a cell phone, like the voice recorder. But I got a chance to do it for real with real equipment and stuff and not no cell phone.
I thought it was a really good opportunity for the people who live here to go around and interview others. Because the people here are growing tired of people from outside. In some cases, they probably even become defensive in ways. and prefer to hold off stories and other information about the hurricane and the storm that may be slightly more personal or more, or that they will be more open to people who live with them and understand what they're experiencing, you know. And so I think that's the major reason for this being so special. The reason the people don't want to tell everything to outsiders has a lot to do with, I think, the media fabricating an idea of them. Like, it's more so that the people are being fabricated, their stories are being fabricated, and if people who live here actually do it themselves, they understand what the person they're speaking with is going through. And I think it's a good way for some people to release on maybe hidden stress or anger, and it's been really helpful to the people since we've been doing interviews.
We talked about like how they miss their hometown, how it is like living back here, FEMA, like if something be broken or stuff, they don't come right away, they come like the next week later. And like how I got formaldehyde in the trailers, about the buses, like if you wake up at 4, like if you have to go to work for 4, you gotta wake up about an hour or 2 hours earlier so you catch the bus in time, if you don't have no car.
The issues that are important to people around here usually have to do with their health and maybe their mental well-being and physical ability to get places. It seems to be things that are physical in a general sense. If we had a way to get out of this place on a daily basis, I think there'd be a lot less frustration within the people, the body of the people living here, because there'd be a way for them to escape their living situation, you know. It's just not healthy for people to live in situations like this. To be honest, I don't believe people all around the country know that this park exists. I don't believe people around the country, some, even know that the hurricane is still an issue. Where they've placed us is basically out of the world. We're almost out of our country to a degree, because we're not really being paid any attention to. It's really like we're just lost. We've been put out here in order to disappear. We've been placed into this area to just sort of go away. The government seems like they want us to disappear. They just want us to vanish, you know, so that they don't have to keep their priorities on this. So it just seems like they're trying to get rid of the problem simply by getting rid of us.
Coming up next.
I used to think a four-letter word that started with F was definitely not FEMA, but it has become that since Katrina.
We'll hear more from work produced by the People's Production House in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For more information, or for a CD copy of this program, please call 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Following the devastations of Hurricane Katrina and Rita, many people were left homeless in Gulfport, Mississippi. More than 2 years later, the pace of the rebuilding process is very slow, and residents living in FEMA trailers constantly face difficulties when repairs are needed. This piece was produced by Anshanice Levison, a resident living in a FEMA trailer park who was also trained by the People's Production House. Anshanice is with the Mississippi Worker Center for Human Rights, a community organizing group that helps residents with housing emergencies. This is her report.
My name is Anshanice Levison. I am a community organizer with the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights, focusing on housing conditions. Mississippi is faced with a housing crisis that is forcing many residents into substandard living. As part of my job, I pay visits to residents living in dilapidated conditions. The Gulf Coast is suffering from a lack of housing due to the devastation of Katrina and has placed many residents in a class system that they are not familiar with.
It didn't matter whether you were black, white, blue, or green. It was just the fact that you were low-income housing, and everybody was subjected to those conditions. So low-income housing in that sector was bad. And then you also had the sector of the immigrant community, or the community that was kind of the invisible community, which nobody really cares to talk about, but does exist, and they're living in real adverse conditions because nobody cares about them.
Vicky Sintra is a resident of the Gulf Coast. While Katrina was devastating, she also points out that housing conditions were poor beforehand.
And you know, I know God works in mysterious ways, and I know there's a reason why he allowed my husband and I to live in a low-income housing unit pre-Katrina, and it was because of my husband's surgery. And this was probably in the year 2003, 2004, somewhere in there, and we lived there for about a year. And we still had to pay rent. We still had to pay, it was like $300 and some rent for this one-bedroom, itty-bitty, tiny apartment on the ground floor. Just to give you an idea, the toilets would overflow every so often, so the bathrooms and the carpet in the bedroom would flood with black waters, and just they would never fix it. It was constantly complaining, and we still had to pay rent.
Vicky describes the situation of the FEMA trailer in which she is residing.
So we moved into this mobile home, which is considered an ADA mobile home for people that have disabilities, in December of 2005. Shortly after that, the first rainstorm came, and we actually had more rain inside the trailer than we did outside. It flooded. The whole kitchen flooded. So we called FEMA maintenance. They came out and said, and the water would just gush through the window in the kitchen. I mean, just literal rainfall just coming through. And they said, oh, yeah, it's a leak. We can't do anything until it stops raining. All right, fine. So they came out, supposedly fixed it, put all this caulking out there, very sloppy type work, and just real, like, no pride in anybody in what they do. And so the next rainfall, we still got flooded. They kept coming out, and I've got all these work orders, you know, numbers. And then shortly after that, this black mold started to grow underneath my sink. And I would call them up, and they sent somebody out, and he got underneath there, pulled out the panel, and said, well, FEMA's not going to remediate any of that black mold. All you can do is spray it down. And when you spray it down, it comes back out because it's inside the walls. It's not just on the outside, but it's inside the wall. So the only way to get it out is you have to actually tear out the wall and pull out the sheetrock, pull out the insulation, and get in there and spray inside the studs. But they're not going to do that, he said. This is 2 years ago almost.
And she says her neighbors aren't faring any better.
A lot of violations within the living conditions of people.
The perception of FEMA to the residents of the Mississippi Gulf Coast is not always the same rescue mission team as others may believe. For Vicky, FEMA means something entirely different than Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Well, wow, it's FEMA. You know, I used to think a four-letter word that started with F was definitely not FEMA, but it has become that since Katrina.
Through all of this, FEMA's emergency housing program is not easy to navigate, especially by phone.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling FEMA. My name is Christy. Can I help?
Yes, I want to call with a maintenance complaint about my FEMA trailer.
Okay, what's wrong with your trailer, ma'am?
I have a leakage at the back of it that is causing the water pressure to be low, and the water would not come on.
So you don't have any water right now? Okay. Is that a number I can call you back on? Okay, our system is down right now, and I'm not ordered to get you a work order number, but as soon as it comes back up, I'll call you back and get your work order number for it.
And the thing is that it's the back, the buck passing, the typical type of situation that we live in the United States every day. You know, it's FEMA's fault. No, it's Heritage's fault. No, it's the other maintenance company. No, it was the maintenance man. No, it was so-and-so. No, it was that. And if I go through that, here I am an activist. Of course, I really don't have time for my own activism. You know, I do everybody else's. But, I mean, I know how to get around. I know how to loop around. I know who to call. I know what to do. And if I have that kind of issue, imagine, just imagine what people that have been stepped on, trampled on, have always been, just pushed around and made part of the system, that don't know how to defend themselves, that think that they don't have a way out. Imagine what they're going through.
Vicki says the personal toll on the residents is heavy.
People that went through Katrina are people that are subjected to a lot of emotional trauma, physical trauma. They've been abused and neglected and, just all kinds of stuff. And sometimes you get people on the phone that are compassionate, but in many cases you get people on the phone that are just very rude and not trained to properly handle these calls. So I guess, you know, to blame, it would have to be FEMA, because they should have the responsibility of training people and putting people that are properly, adequately capable of handling the people and the amount of people that are calling in. That's one issue. I mean, I've had people tell me that I should be grateful to FEMA that I have a roof over my head and stop complaining about all the issues that I have.
With activists struggling to receive proper treatment and assistance from the government, non-activists are really at a disadvantage. They have to track down the appropriate authority figure and explain a situation to someone they feel should be aware of the issues they face. Residents are reluctant to discuss their situations or request FEMA landlords to complete maintenance requests because they fear mistreatment and eviction. Many individuals don't realize they can make complaints and insist on improvements and be protected under law from retribution from FEMA and landlords. This is why we at the Mississippi Workers Center conduct Know Your Rights workshops. At the workshops, we provide attendees with manuals that detail state and federal law protections. The center gives residents time to trust us and believe we are here to stand alongside them and help fight for their rights for affordable and decent housing. Everyone, please remember that a housing right is a human right. This is Antonice Levison with the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights from Greenville, Mississippi.
Starting in March 2008, FEMA says it plans to raise rents at Renaissance Village by $50 a month, and another $50 each month after that until November, when the park is expected to shut down. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to all the people who contributed to this program: Socket Sony, Anshanice Levison, Eric Walker, Rashika London, and Kiana London, and to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew. Also, much appreciation to the People's Production House and the Ms. Foundation for providing some of the audio. For a CD copy of program number 4507, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Puck Lowe associate producer, Joaquin Palomino sound editor intern, Samson Rainey intern, and I'm senior producer Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.